Hello there, and welcome back to Scene by Scene with Josh and Dean, the podcast where we break down the movie American Splendor scene by scene and talk about Harvey Pekar and discuss the joys and challenges of being professional cartoonists, which is what we are. I am Josh Neufeld of joshneufeld.com.
And I'm Dean Haspiel of deanhaspiel.com.
Nice to meet you. Today we are discussing scene 16 of our podcast, which is DVD chapter 10, which starts at minute 37, second 11, and ends at minute 41, second 38. And this scene starts with the caption, "Meanwhile in Delaware," and ends with Harvey and Joyce negotiating on the phone.
Yeah, as you said, there's a caption. Again, this is a device that's been used in the movie several times where they show a caption box like a caption box in comic books. And it says, "Meanwhile in Delaware." So we're transitioning to another state from Cleveland. And we start with the exterior of Cosmic Comics. And then we cut inside and we are introduced to a new character. The character of Joyce Brabner, as played by Hope Davis. Joyce is organizing comics on the floor of her co-owned comic book shop. It appears that she can't find the latest issue of American Splendor, and she kind of has a little mini meltdown. Her co-owner of the shop, I believe his name is Rand, he's kind of like a hippie burnout, thinks that they may have sold out of the issue, and Joyce gets upset. So he suggests, well, why don't you just contact the publisher? Or she's like, you know, I'll just contact the publisher. And we all know, the ones who've been watching the movie, that the publisher is just Harvey, you know, self-publishing this effort.
I'm surprised she doesn't know that.
Well, who knows? I guess, did he have a company name? Was there a company?
I don't think so. I think it just said Harvey Pekar.
All right. And she gets a little upset. She goes, why does everything in my life have to be a complicated disaster? I guess it was kind of like a little mantra of hers. And every time the Joyce character talks, there's always a provocative sentence or something really kind of curious and interesting throughout the rest of the movie when she's talking about anything.
She definitely makes a strong first impression. She's not just like a generic female love interest.
So with her complicated disaster explosion, Rand feels the bad vibes happening, man, and decides he's going to split. And so
you can just hang.
So rather than call, Joyce writes a letter to Harvey, and it sparks this really cool montage between Joyce writing letters from her bed or at the comic shop to Harvey getting letters and, you know, checking his mailbox, and this back and forth of her writing, him opening up the mailbox. You can tell that he's getting kind of excited by these letters. He likes these letters. At some point, we see him sitting on the toilet, and he remarks, he goes, man, she's got some good-looking handwriting, you know, which, again, romantic comedy. This is the funny stuff. And it turns out, you know, through revelations through these letters, that Joyce is a sometime activist and teaches writing to prisoners. So in the letter writing, you know, Harvey tries to write some letters back, and there's actually this funny moment that has got to have been improvised or an accident that they kept into the movie, where Harvey, as played by Paul Giamatti, is sitting on a bed with a single piece of paper on a bed that, you know, is very movable, right?
And smushy.
And he starts to write and say something like, "Dear Joyce," and then his pencil, you know, pokes a hole through the paper that he's writing. And there's like, it's almost like a record scratch. It kind of like, the movie stops for a second.
Yes.
And it's just like really cool music that was playing. Suddenly the music stops. And then then he continues again to start over.
He doesn't learn his lesson, by the way. He continues writing on the bed, on the paper. On the bed, but somehow he survived. The second letter survived.
So there was a little comedy gold happening at that point in the movie. And then, you know, she's worried about meeting Harvey. I mean,
he asks her to come and, you know, he's like, when are you going to come to Cleveland after all this back and forth?
So there's this letter writing happening, and then transitions to the telephone. Mm-hmm. So they're talking on the phone. It becomes a little more comfortable, a little more intimate. But Joyce is worried about meeting Harvey because of the different ways the artists draw him, from the likes of a younger Brando to the way Crumb portrays him as a hairy ape with stink lines. And Pekar says, no, those aren't stink lines. They're motion lines. I'm an active guy.
And meanwhile, he's lying on his back on the bed, clipping his toenails.
That's right, doing nothing. Although it did make me think, like, what, and we'll get to the rest of the scene in a moment, but what did you think those lines were when you saw them in comics?
distinct lines?
Well, he says they're undulating, you know, like, and they're motion.
Well, with Crumb, it's like there's so much going on in every panel. There's so much undulation.
There's so much undulation happening. Do you think that
people are like, yeah, people are constantly, it's like those old Mickey Mouse cartoons where everybody was kind of like, you know, bouncing up and down all the time.
For me, if it was around elbows and knees and body parts, that's movement. You know, that's shaking. Right. But if it is rising off the top of the head.
That's stink lines?
I always felt that meant stink
lines. Wouldn't they come out of the butt, though?
Well, that, yes, of course, you know, in other parts of the body like that. But to me, or maybe that would represent heat, like they're sweating or hot, you know? Anyway, so as I said, the letter writing soon transitions into talking on the phone. And Picard establishes that Joyce, you know, he establishes, are you single? You know, are you married? And she says, no, I'm single. I guess she too had been married previously. And
she says, I'm divorced, thank God.
Thank God. And he invites her to meet him in Cleveland to crash at his place. And in their
You know what we should have done with this recap is we should have... You should have read all the Harvey parts and I should have read all the Joyce parts.
Why? I mean, just... Shut up. But in their parlay, Joyce does spill chamomile tea on herself, which becomes an important part of a later scene.
Yeah.
They were seeding the scene.
Important foreshadowing.
That's right.
Chamomile foreshadowing.
So
product placement.
We've actually taken a scene that's probably longer and cut it in half, in a way. Is that what we decided?
No, it's two separate scenes. Yeah, it's chapter breaks.
Okay, it is.
But that does bring us to the source material. You want me to just quickly mention that?
I'll mention, if you have any thoughts on it, this scene is derived from a story called A Marriage Album that both Harvey Picard and Joyce Babner wrote with artist Val Mayerik, who is the co-creator of Howard the Duck.
Yeah.
And
you know that because you're so familiar with the comics, or you
Oh, I knew that. I mean, Howard the Duck?
No, the scene where it came from. Like that it was the inspiration for the scene in the movie.
Howard the Duck would be the inspiration, you mean?
The Marriage Album.
No, I think Howard the Duck was the inspiration. Yeah.
Harvey the Duck.
No. Actually, that is a question we should bring up, though, with Val if we get to talk to him.
Yeah, I think we're hoping to talk to
because Howard the Duck
the artist
also
for that
came
that
from
scene.
Cleveland.
Howard the Duck came from Cleveland?
Yeah, that's right.
All right.
All right. So going back to A Marriage Album, which was from American Splendor number 10, published in 1985. That was the year that you and I graduated high school, by the way.
Oh, my God. I got to cut that out. I'll change it to 2005.
Okay. So, and it's a really interesting comic, and maybe because Joyce was involved in it, the structure is very interesting.
Yes.
I don't know how much we can get into it because some of the source material is also used late in the next scene. Is that correct?
Yeah, but I think most of it is, I mean, a good chunk of it is from this scene. So, yeah, let's get into it.
I don't know if this was the first time that Joyce collaborated with Picard in American Splendor.
I believe so, but we'd have to double check that.
We'll have to double check that. But oddly enough, it kind of starts off with, unless she's been in the comic previously, right? Like, as
well, I think
the girlfriend.
This was the first issue of American Splendor that she showed up in, I believe.
And she's already his girlfriend. It's
well,
like
they got married in 1984 and this came out in 1985.
Okay.
So, and I'm not sure, you know, how far back the stories correspond to the time period, but I think they're already married or.
So real quick, he was putting out one issue a year.
Right.
So you think he had finally caught up and was just like basically had to wait a year to publish a comic to get the material?
I think that basically what was happening by this time is. Basically, each new issue of American Splendor was like, this is what I've been up to for the last year.
Okay.
You know?
So then, structurally, it gets really interesting because it's written from two different points of views. Obviously, Harvey's and then Joyce's. And it kind of meets in the middle. And it kind of skirts over stuff without telling you.
Yeah, there's a lot of showing and not telling in the comic itself.
But you do learn a lot about Joyce throughout this comic. And of course, in the corresponding scene, the next scene.
Right.
And there's this interesting moment in here that isn't covered necessarily in the movie where you see Joyce like in a wheelchair because she's been in a hospital and something has happened to her. But she does explain in the movie how her family was always ill or getting sick.
Yeah. Well, in a couple of scenes coming up, the famous scene, the vomiting scene, I think she talks a lot about how she's sick all the time and her family has a history of different illnesses and she expects to, you know, succumb to some serious illness. So, right. But they refer to it kind of obliquely in the comic too, where she just throws out that she was in the hospital and Harvey was patient with her, and it shows a couple of scenes in her in the hospital, and they never explain what she had, why she was there, whether it was serious or not. Just this throwaway thing.
Right. Sometimes the movie does that, as does a lot of, you know, movies that are based on real people. They might gloss over a few
details. The comic does that.
The movie in conjunction.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that's interesting to me about this scene as it grows, because it's several scenes that you learn this, we go from that last beautiful scene where, you know, there's this hint of a possible connection with an old classmate to this kind of morbid, almost poetic loneliness, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's how it ended.
And then so it sets you up for like, oh, come on, Harvey, I'm rooting for you. I hope somebody likes you.
Right.
And it starts with a fan.
Yeah.
You know, a fan is like disgruntled with the fact that they sold the most current issue of the comic she didn't get to read. And so much so that she needs to pursue this, you know, this issue, i.e. this man, to find out more about him. Ooh. And it just sets up this kind of like, this weird new kind of connection, you know.
Well, he found not necessarily a soulmate, but someone who shares his general disgruntlement with life.
Through the letter writing,
revealed.
Admits some stuff about where she lives. And mm-hmm. I think that's how she's also connecting with Harvey's stories, because of where he lives and what he talks about. And it's like you said, there is that connection in that. And I thought that was really interesting. And that, because that's not necessarily normal either. Although I guess we all connect to our favorite artists and writers in some way, or singers and mm-hmm. you know, performers through their work, you know, but not always get to date and marry, you know.
Yeah. It made me think about, you know, there's a long tradition in comic books of letter writers, of letters to the editor. Mm-hmm. It used to be a really big thing back in our day, in the 80s and 70s and so forth. And there was this whole community of people who wrote into the letters pages of comics and created relationships with the editors there. And a lot of them ended up actually coming in to work in the comics industry. There's a lot of famous, you know, fans who then became professionals mm-hmm. through their first connection writing in these letters and getting to know the editors at Marvel and DC that way. And there are even stories of letter writers who met each other on the convention circuit later and ended up getting married, and letter writers who then went to work at Marvel and DC and met another professional there and got married. So this is kind of part of that same tradition.
Right. And like people who meet at comic book conventions, so like mm-hmm. we'll get married and stuff like that. And I think my first major comic book collaborations was through comic book letter writing with Martin Powell on The Verdict.
Right.
You know,
was more of like a fan club that you guys were part
still,
of.
But still, the
right?
idea is what connected us was our fandom, you know, for the form.
Right, right.
And curiously, what's interesting about at least superhero comics or, you know, corporate owned comics like Marvel and DC, it started with a lot of like artists and writers who were embarrassed to work in the form. They wanted to be like a writer, wanted to be a real novelist, mm-hmm. or like the artists were like trying to get other kind of jobs but couldn't get it or weren't up to snuff necessarily. Mm-hmm. So they quietly worked in comics and used pseudonyms and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
To then the next kind of comic book writer and artist were the fans.
Mm-hmm.
So it leapt from like blue collar almost working to like true fandom coming in that felt entitled to these works in some way, you know?
That's a really good point.
And then so it was interesting to see how Joyce, you know, was really connecting, or the character of Joyce was connecting with this comic in some kind of like really important way. And again, there weren't a lot of comics like that. And there still aren't a lot of comics like that being made today.
Yeah, well, she felt, and because Harvey had explicitly made it seem like that, here was this real guy on the page. You know, there was no filter between the creator of American Splendor and the guy whose these stories were about.
Right.
And I remember when I first met him in person or started talking to him on the phone, I also was sort of taken aback by that lack of filter. Like, was I allowed to refer to stuff I had read about him in American Splendor while we were just talking on the phone? Or was that kind of like, was there supposed to be some polite barrier between those things? At first, I wasn't quite sure what pose I was supposed to take. And then I realized that, you know, it was all out there. Like, he was sharing his, like you said, it was like his blog, you know, and it was up for debate and open for adding to whatever you already knew about him. So you could know him as a friend and have all sort of his experiences with him, and then you could also know all of these details about him because he had shared them with the world in his comic.
And he put you in his comic, right? Because he did that with me.
I did end up being in a comic that I actually got to illustrate myself, so that was kind of
and I did
thing.
The same thing, and I remember thinking, yeah, that's kind of how it happened. Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't like a lie, so it really felt like all the comics he wrote were as authentic as they could be.
Right. And even though we've talked about how, you know, as someone who shapes the messy events of real life into a more of a structured form of a story, there's still a lot of real stuff that ends up on mm-hmm. the page. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that Joyce in a way felt, you know, like there was nothing, it wasn't too weird to all of a sudden be talking to this guy whose comics she read and sold at her comic book store, because she already sort of knew him and they could bypass a lot of the, you know, the initial getting to know you stuff, because she already knew a lot about him, and then he could ask her, and next thing you know, they're talking like old friends.
And they had to do a really difficult thing in a movie, which is to pretty immediately, like within a scene or two, make you believe that they could go from letter writing to phone calls to literally meeting each other, and not to spoil too much, but just uniting, you mm-hmm. know, and owning that and buying that. And you could tell from her personality and his personality, which are very different, that there was not a match made in heaven necessarily, but that you could see how they could keep each other interested,
yeah.
you know, in each other.
Yeah, definitely a lot in common, and in at least their way of framing their own experiences and looking at the world outside.
Mm-hmm.
So getting into the scene a little bit, and just a little bit more about the original comic, just little details. So in the original comic, she was missing American Splendor number 6, mm-hmm. which came out in 1981. So that kind of gave me the clue as to when she and Harvey first started corresponding, which would have been, you know, like they would have had a multi-year correspondence, like 81 to 84, say, or 83 or whatever. Whereas in the movie, they say American Splendor number 8. And then this came out in American Splendor number 10. So they're kind of, again, truncating things in the movie to sort of make things feel more immediate and fresh. And I guess in real life, they had a longer period of sort of getting to know each other. It wasn't quite such as a whirlwind as is shown in the movie. And then one other just little difference is the comic shop that she actually owned was, in the movie, it's called Cosmic Comics. In real life, it was Comic Books, Comics, and Costumes. So it was a costume store as well. And in the original story, there's even a scene showing her like outfitting somebody in a giant like mascot uniform of some kind. And in those days, that must have been really kind of an odd combination of comics and costumes. But now with all the cosplaying and everything that goes on, I'm sure that there's lots of comic stores which also delve into the realm of cosplay.
I mean, she was ahead of the curve.
And then I was trying to figure out like where they actually shot those scenes, because it really looked like the interior looked like a real comic book store. It did not look like a fake store that somebody had, you know, like some set designer had created. And so I would assume, since they shot the film in Cleveland, that it was a Cleveland store, but I have not been able to find any information about that. And there is a Cosmic Comics in Baltimore. And so we were looking at the pictures of the inside of that store, and they look kind of similar to this, but I don't know why they would have shot those interiors in Baltimore, because they didn't shoot anything else there as far as I know. So that's a mystery, which we will try to look into. But one thing that was funny was if you noticed in the foreground, when they first open up in the interior of the store, there's a pillar that has some comics stocked on it that we can actually see the titles. Mm-hmm. And one of them is Comics Book. Mm-hmm. Do you know about Comics Book?
Marvel.
Yeah.
They produced 2 issues.
Mm-hmm.
Dennis Kitchen.
Yeah. So
and Stan Lee.
And
basically,
Stan Lee.
It was their collaboration to basically curate an indie type comic for published by Marvel.
Right. It was an underground comic published by Marvel, except that since it was controlled by the Comics Code, none of the content could actually be very undergroundy. So it didn't really work out. I think, it was a very strange project. And then after 2 issues, Marvel dropped it, and Dennis Kitchen Sink publishers picked it up and published 2 more issues. And the interesting thing about that, and I think it got to be a little more undergroundy then, was that one of Harvey Pekar's first published comics was actually in Comics Book.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It was before American Splendor. I don't have it on hand, but I believe it was illustrated by Willie Murphy. And so it's funny that they sort of seeded that into this scene, also because I'm sure they were trying to find comics that kind of, you know, wouldn't be they wouldn't have to get the licensing from Marvel or DC to put there and would look right for that kind of indie store and wouldn't date the place. Mm-hmm. Like if they put a, you know, a contemporary comic there that they'd actually got in the store, obviously that would throw off the whole chronology of the movie.
Right. Also in America's Wonder, number 10, 1985, he's still being called Herschel.
Well, she calls him that. Yeah. So that's interesting. I'm glad you brought that up. In the comic itself, it starts off like with this framing sequence of them already living together. And there's a friend of Joyce's who comes to pick her up and take her out for like a reading group or something. And this woman, Maxine and Harvey are talking about literature, and she gives him a guilt trip about a book that he hasn't read yet and yada, yada, yada. At some point, Joyce comes up to Harvey and says, Herschel, we got to go. So is that like her pet name for him because she found out that was his actual name? Because that was his given name was Herschel. I guess like his Hebrew / Jewish name was Herschel, but everybody knew him as Harvey. And I think he's been known as Harvey pretty much his whole life, but his parents call him Herschel in The Quitter mm-hmm. and in some earlier, you know, stories about his young life. So that's kind of interesting.
Maybe it also shows if she was co-writing this comic that she felt she wanted to say that as to give like a sense of intimacy. Like, I know your real name,
right.
or your given name
or something
like that, you know?
So she can summon him to her circle of hell whenever. Oh, what did I say that out loud? Whenever she needs to. So yeah, there are just so many great details about the way that the that scene was shot and the intro to Joyce Brabner. I think Hope Davis really embodies Joyce and is on equal footing with Paul Giamatti's Harvey mm-hmm. in this movie. Like, she can go toe to toe with him. And that's a hard, you know, because he's already established this character as being, you know, a force to be reckoned with. And here we have someone who's his equal.
Well, not only his equal, but interested in him more than anybody else. Like, mm-hmm. he comes off as a grump, so most people, understandably,
like,
could just walk
away. Yeah.
So there's Crumb, who's drawn to him, you know, literally. And then we haven't met Toby yet, right?
Yeah, we met Toby with the jelly beans.
That's right. We met Toby. So there's Toby and then there's Joyce. Again, there's this collection of misfits that are really fascinating characters.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Accruing a kind of a gang, you know, of sorts. You know, the very kids he didn't get to hang out with at the very first shot of the movie at the trick-or-treating. These are his costume characters, you know?
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah, you're right. And as we'll find out later, they all have personality disorders of some kind or another
that's
that are
right.
diagnosed.
According to Joyce.
Which is their superpower. So one person's, you know, medical diagnosis is another person's superpower.
That's right. That's right. So I guess I have a few questions based on this little interaction they have. Have you ever invited someone to stay with you that you've never met before? But obviously you knew them in another way, but you physically had not met them.
Well, I told you the story, and I told our listeners about the time that Harvey and Joyce almost came and stayed with me in Chicago.
Right.
And I'd never actually met them at that point, but had talked to them on the phone. And like I said, I knew them quite well, and especially Harvey through his comics. So I don't know if that really counts. There was one other time, the closest that I can think of offhand is a woman that I met in England when I was there on a quick, like, business trip that I had a little
fling
with, that I unwisely invited to come back and stay with me in New York. And that did not turn out well. So I might have learned my lesson from that.
I've definitely had those myself.
Yeah.
I definitely have, like, met, you know, I guess with the advent of online dating, you know, you think you might know someone well enough, kind of like what
right.
Harvey and Joyce
yeah,
were doing.
This
you know?
Was online dating
in
that day.
Then you meet them and you're like, oh no. And I'm sure I've been an oh no to other people.
Right.
You know?
Well, that's what they say. I wouldn't know about this because I'm happily married and have been for 20 years. But I hear that on the online dating, a big thing is, you know, your profile picture.
Right.
And a lot of people let's say, fudge that picture a little bit.
Right.
Maybe use a picture that's 10 years old and
right.
20 pounds lighter or really good lighting. And that's kind of what Joyce was getting to. But, and I also love that she just came right out and said it. Like, well, you know, not to seem shallow, but the reason I'm scared to come and meet you is because I don't know what you're going to look like.
Right. It's great.
He didn't seem to worry about that at all, because
like, no.
he knew her handwriting was nice. So
her handwriting's yeah. great. That's all yeah. that mattered, man. And what she talked about, you know,
right.
clearly that's what they were both connecting on. You
yes.
know,
it was a meeting of the minds.
No, but I, speaking of like online dating and kind of like being who you are, like I think today I've heard that people hire professional photographers and
right.
resume writers
uh-huh.
and to make them sound cool. A mutual friend of ours, Tim Hall, who's a writer, debunked that years ago when there was nerve.com, and I don't know if that's still around. One of his profile, or his profile, the moniker he used was OTB guy, you know, off track betting.
Oh, gosh. that sends all the messages.
And,
right
and
there.
He did that on purpose to
that's
debunk
right.
the idea
sure, sure.
of, you know, knight
just
in shining
lower
armor.
Expectations.
Yeah, Lancelot, Sir
yeah.
Lancelot over here, you know.
Well, Lancelot rides horses. OTB is about horses.
Oh,
yeah,
look
so,
at you with
yeah.
the connections over
mm-hmm.
here. And yeah, no, I've had my share of having invited someone over and it feeling like, how long is it going to be before we don't need to be around each other right now?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I've had some bad luck with knowing someone a little bit and then the mistake of having them come to stay for a while, but not straight off like just some phone calls and correspondence. But it does beg the question, and I think we'll get to this next episode, is sort of like what each of them was looking for from the beginning. Like we know that from the beginning, Joyce just wanted that issue of American Splendor. She loved the comic
right.
and she was pissed at her co-owner for having sold it out from under her. She wanted to read it. That was her agenda. Harvey's agenda, apparently right from the beginning, was he liked her handwriting and he was interested in her and was lonely, as we know from the previous scene. And he makes it pretty clear right away that he's interested in her romantically. With Joyce, it's not quite clear to me in the movie, like at what point does she actually become interested in this guy? And I have to say in the Marriage Album story too, it's because they avoid romantic
right.
language so explicitly, and there's a lot of writing and conversation that happens in this scene that was never in the original story at all. Like all of that background stuff that Joyce talks about, you know, corporate chemical companies and lives of suffocating depression and things like that were just written explicitly for the film, as far as I could tell.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I'm not quite sure if I'm seeing the progression of her going from wanting an issue of a comic book to her active interest in this guy that she's now starting to get to know. What
yeah.
about you?
I mean, again, they were able to sell how they could get together and then stay together. But it didn't feel, like you said, there wasn't that romantic kind
yeah.
of like,
and
know,
I definitely want to talk about that with the next,
you know,
the next couple of scenes.
And that's part of the romantic comedy part. Like, how
mm-hmm.
is this a romance? You know,
right.
like, because you're waiting for the romance.
Right.
And the romance
you'll
is their
keep
connection.
Waiting.
Yeah, you keep waiting. But so they debunk that idea as well,
mm-hmm.
you know. But I also think that, you know, as you get older, you start to recognize some of your friends and some people, man, they don't date. They get married.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the minute they find a connection with
yeah.
someone, there isn't dating anymore.
Right.
And they're not like players out in the field, you know.
It's
and they,
like they have a set of boxes that they want to tick off, you
sure,
know.
Sure. And as long as those boxes are ticked off, not to remove the humanity of it, but, you know, they're like, this is great, you know, because I found someone that I can tolerate. I hate
right.
to put it in those terms, but, you know. So
how romantic.
So I have another question. We basically realized that maybe it was Joyce's character was like wanted the next issue of American Splendor that got sold out from under her. And that turned into a relationship, not necessarily a romance and not necessarily a crush. So maybe this question is moot in this podcast, but have you ever, you know, was there like a long distance and then you finally got to meet that person? And it doesn't even have to be sexual. It could be, you know, you admire their work so much and that you pursued this person because of their work. And it turned into like a friendship or something like that.
Yeah, I would say, and probably in the comics world, you know, especially like when I was starting out and getting interested in indie comics and starting to correspond with some of the cartoonists who I really admired. So it was probably more of like a cartoonist crush, you
mm-hmm.
know, than anything
mm-hmm.
else. I mean, Harvey Pekar was one of those people,
right.
you know, I was reading his comics and starting to develop my own aspirations to work in the indie, you know, side of the industry. And as I read his comics and got to know him and got to know his work, I really developed an affinity for what he was doing. And then that turned into a desire to want to illustrate his stories, to bond with him, you know, directly. And then plus with my own ambition and looking at some of the other artists' work and feeling like, yeah, sure, I don't have the resume that some of these people do, but I feel like I could do this. Mm-hmm. I'm as good as some of these other artists. Mm-hmm. And so actually, you know, I'm glad you asked that question, because I would say that's exactly what happened. And then, you know, it turned into an actual relationship and turned out very well. And it's hopefully for both of us.
Because as we were both grew up reading superhero comics, and then we both discovered, you know, I guess in different ways, the alternative indie comics route, you know, Harvey Pekar's American Splendor, Chester Brown's Yummy Fur, so on and so forth, Peter Bagg, you know, all those, the Hernandez brothers and all that, Dan Klaus. But I think initially, realistically, I think I wanted to draw Harvey Pekar, but I wasn't nearly as interested as you were. Mm-hmm. But when you got the job, I had to prove to you that I was better.
Yes.
So, and I think we've discussed this. And again, it's half joking.
I mean,
there is joking. There's a joking aspect to that. But I do wonder, like, because I don't know if I ever would have pursued Pekar if you hadn't pursued him.
Oh, I'm sure you wouldn't have.
I probably wouldn't have, you know? Which is interesting because he put me on the map. The Quitter, I believe, is what kind of put me on the map, you know, in the comics world.
Huh.
You know, having got my name out there in a collaboration with Harvey.
Yeah. That's funny. I don't see your career that way as you know, someone who's been very close to your career from high school onward. It feels like you earned it in a lot of different ways, and kind of, you know, you had your eggs in so many baskets, and you knew so many different people at so many different ends of the industry, and just gradually earned your way to the lofty heights that you are today. But it's interesting that you feel like, you know, the Quitter was really a big turning point for you.
It was.
I do remember when you and Harvey were at the Barnes & Noble on Union Square, and they were like, you know, it was a packed house and you guys were signing, and I did feel like, oh, Dean has hit the big time now. So, you know, maybe that was that moment for you. I remember I was pissed because I waited in line like everybody else to get my book signed by both of you guys, and you didn't even like give me a special, like you just signed your name like everybody else. And I think later I gave you a guilt trip about that, and you did a little bit of a, you know, a sketch in the book and made a personal thing. But I was like, what's going on here? I'm just nothing. Just another person online.
So,
another fan.
The thing you don't know yet about becoming famous,
I'd have to be famous.
Is that all the people you knew, their last name becomes Who? So you're like, Josh Who? Is what happens when you're standing online.
Yes.
No, but I honestly don't think I ever would have worked with Harvey had I not felt a healthy competition with you at the time. So I thank you.
Okay, yeah.
How about that?
You're welcome. I guess.
There's the plot twist right there. And my last question is, what's been your most interesting correspondence with a fan via letters, phone, email, whatever? Or do you have stuff like that?
I would say that's always been a big motivation of mine for doing the work I do, is making that connection with readers. Mm-hmm. And having somebody, you know, communicate to me the feelings and respect that they had towards my work that I used to do back when I was in high school and college. Because I was always a letter writer. I wrote letters into DC and Marvel Comics. And then as I got older and started reading Dan Klaus and Chris Ware and Peter Bagg and Adrian Tomine and Julie Doucet and all of those people, I would write postcards and letters to them too. Peter Cooper, mm-hmm. you know, and I formed relationships with some of those folks because of that. So I felt like that's, you know, this is an ongoing tradition. And one of the great things about the comics world is that people are pretty receptive to that. And you can meet people that way and have a relationship with somebody you admire. So a big part of the gratification that I've gotten as a cartoonist over the years, especially like with AD and a little bit of A Few Perfect Hours to my travel book, is when people have written into me, emails nowadays mostly, or on message boards or at conventions, where they've struck up relationships with me because they liked my work. And then that's turned into, you know, actual friendships, mm-hmm. and there are a number of people, and then there's been academics and people in the, you know, in the world of academia and education and things like that, where those kinds of opportunities have happened because we had formed that sort of connection. So that's something that I think is something that's been really important to me in my career. So thanks for asking. What about you?
The greatest currency is that correspondence, mm-hmm. is that connection, to the point where I still, to this day, at near age 52, will still write someone if I've been, you know, impacted or they made me feel something about, you know, their work. Even if it's someone I've written to before in the past, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't end. You know, they don't get their milestone and then no one ever talks to them again, you know,
kind of thing. Right.
Most artists continue making art, you know. And to me, yes, it's great if you can buy something and keep me in business, you know, but that whether it's a thank you or an acknowledgement or even a criticism or something, mm-hmm. but it's heartfelt and meaningful.
Yeah.
That to me is, I worry that we're going to lose that with, you know, our Twitters and tweets and, you know, anger and outrage that's been kind of taking over more lately than ever before. But I know that I try to remember to do that for other people because it has been done for me and I know how important it is when it continues to come my way.
Yeah, it's funny to be at a stage in our careers now where we're the ones who are receiving that sort of, you know, reaching out from the younger generation,
right.
and are able to pass on the sort of positivity and collegial lessons that I think we picked up from the people that, you know, we did that with.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think that was one thing that I really liked too, is back when I was into superhero comics and would write, you know, into the Marvel and DC or meet various heroes of mine at conventions, is in general, it felt like to me that industry, the mainstream industry, wasn't quite as nice to their fans and aspiring professionals as the indie comics and alt comics people felt. Like,
right.
I really felt like at home right away when I started doing these kind of comics, in much more so than mm-hmm. I had felt back when it was superhero folks.
And even
maybe that's different now.
Well, I mean, a few weeks ago I was at Wohop, my favorite Chinese place. You know, I've been going to
beef
since,
with tomato.
That's right. I've been going to since I was an embryo in my mother's stomach, and it was probably like, I don't know, 2 a.m. or something like that on a Saturday night, and I was drunk and I wanted to go get some food, and I happened to be by myself. I guess I had left the group I was with to go get some food to then go home, and I wait online, I get inside. So they sat me at this huge table that no one was at, but obviously they were going to fill that table.
Mm-hmm.
So I ordered my food, and lo and behold, four people show up, and, you know, we kind of nod at each other just to acknowledge and everything's cool. And there's this tall woman sits next to me, young woman, and, you know, she's very nice. And I don't know how we got to talking, but her name is Coca, and she is does a travel guide and EMT as well. And she's in New York with these gigs. But she also, we connected on the fact that I do comics and she loves comics.
Hmm.
So we were talking, whatever, back and forth. I showed her some stuff on my phone, you know, from the Red Hook that I'm doing online at Line Webtoon. And we talked a little bit about that. And then she got my number and immediately emailed me that at that moment to my email.
Oh, cool.
And so, like, the next day I get the email, I correspond back. I was like, listen, anytime if you're in the neighborhood, you want to swing by the shared studio that I have with mm-hmm. a bunch of other cartoonists, swing by and bring something to draw, you know. Couple weeks go by and she emails me. She's like, I'd love to come by. She comes by last week, sitting there steeping in the energy of just like, and you know, she's coming to meet strangers basically, you know.
Yeah.
And she brought a sketchbook and showed us some of what she's doing, and she sat at one of the art tables, and I saw that she was struggling.
How did the person who was also sitting there handle that?
You have to kill everything. You have to destroy.
Sorry, I can't help myself.
You're a complicated disaster, Josh. No, so that person wasn't there. It was an empty seat, Josh.
Oh, I see.
Okay.
I gotcha.
So she's sitting there, and I see her struggling with this drawing. She's kind of drawing over and over again with this lead pencil. And I said to her, do you ever use a blue pencil? And she's like, what are you talking about? And I showed her the blue pencil that I use. She said she's used other ones, but nothing like this one because it's a particular type
mm-hmm.
that, you know how blue pencils can be very waxy and annoying. And
the non-repro
ones. That's right.
Ones.
So yeah. I showed her mine, and I said, if you just use this, it'll be your underdrawing, and you can fuck that up, and it doesn't matter. And then mm-hmm. you can, quote, ink with mm-hmm. the pencil that you brought, right?
Good tip.
About 5 minutes later, she's like, oh my God. I was like, what? She's like, this is incredible. This blue pencil is just, it's changing everything in the way I think about. And she started thanking me profusely. And I was like, listen, it's all our jobs to pay it forward. Mm-hmm. You know, even if it's just a damn blue pencil to help you get that drawing along easier, you know?
Nice. Wow. Just let that moment sit there for a second.
Get off my lap.
Oh, I didn't know that seat was occupied. Sorry. Well, that about wraps up this episode. We're looking forward to the next one. We'll see more of Joyce and Harvey and their romance. Remember, you can visit us at Scene by Scene on Facebook, where you can join the discussion. And also, you can visit us on scenebyscenepodcast.com, our official website, where you can subscribe, download and listen to past episodes, read up on the show, check out our work, and more. And please visit us on Apple Podcasts, on iTunes. Give us 5 stars or a rating that shows you like us, because it'll help us get more listeners. And until next time, when we will be discussing episode number 17, this is Josh Neufeld
and Dean Haspiel
with Scene by Scene with Josh and Dean.